From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Welcome to the day after the 2018 midterm elections. It was a night of many firsts, including those long lines of voters. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, joined us through the long night last night. We're continuing that conversation today. There is always some clarity the morning after. I'd like to know, Ken, what you think the headline is as we begin this morning.
Well, the headline has to be that the Democrats took control of the House. I mean, obviously, we've had one-party rule since Donald Trump was elected in 2016. There's been really no check on his presidency. And the fact that the Democrats, at least as of we're talking right now, picked up maybe 27 seats or so, far more than the 23 they needed to get the majority. That's the big headline. But at the same time, it's not the worst day in the world or the worst election in the world for the Republican Party, even though, you know, a president usually does very poorly in the first midterm. The Republicans did pick up a bunch of Senate seats, perhaps more than most people thought. You know, they knocked off incumbents in Indiana and North Dakota and Florida and Missouri. So that was good for the Republican Party. And while they, you know, they didn't do great in some governor's races, they won some big seats as well in Georgia, in Florida, in Ohio. Matter of fact, there was so much attention on the so-called darlings of the Democratic Party, the Beto O'Rourke's in Texas, Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and Andrew Gillum in Florida. And as of now, it seems like all three have lost. So the headline is the House. A mixed bag all in all.
I'm not sure that that result is final in Georgia yet, just because there's talk of a recount or some conditional ballots that still need to be counted.
That is absolutely correct. And of course, if Brian Kemp, the Republican who is currently leading, if he falls, even if he has a lead, if he falls under 50%, Georgia law calls for a runoff between the top two candidates. So we may not have heard the end of Georgia as of yet.
So in his remarks this morning, President Trump said the blue wave, I don't know if there ever was such a thing, but he touted this largest Senate gain for a president's party in midterm elections since I think he went back to 1962. And he's placing a lot of emphasis on the tremendous victory, not only in the congressional seats, but in the governor's races as well. I do want to step back a little bit and say, what's the glass half full, but also the glass half empty view for President Trump in this election?
Well, I think the things that stuck most with me with Trump in this morning's press conference, first of all, he listed the Republicans who lost in the House by name of those who didn't embrace the Trump presidency or the Trump philosophy. And he named a bunch of them, Barbara Comstock of Virginia, Mike Kaufman of Colorado, others like that, Mia Love of Utah. And basically he said, well, they rejected me. They didn't embrace me. And so they lost. So I thought it was kind of odd that he would name the Republicans.
Right.
That was kind of strange. And then he also said that, you know, in the races for governor, you can't get bigger than Florida, Iowa, Ohio, and Georgia. He said, these are big states. You can't get bigger than that. But of course, he didn't mention that the Republicans lost bigger states in Michigan and Illinois. But I mean, that's part of it as well. But I just kind of think, though, that for the most part, it is a mixed bag. I think, you know, the president sees it. We'll see almost everything is a victory. I think a big question is also, where do we go from here? Because now that the Democrats have subpoena power, investigative power, and other things like that in the House, does the president reach out to Nancy Pelosi, should she be the speaker, or whoever heads up the Democrats? Or does he become even more combative for the next 2 years? My guess, it's the latter.
In a tweet this morning, the president wrote, in all fairness, Nancy Pelosi deserves to be chosen Speaker of the House by the Democrats. If they give her a hard time, perhaps we will add some Republican votes. She has earned this great honor, exclamation point, to which a lot of people say, oh, he's just getting ready for this rivalry.
Oh, that's exactly right. This is vintage Trump because he knows that many of the candidates, I don't know how what percentage, but a good number of Democrats who were elected to the House yesterday did so by promising they would not support Nancy Pelosi for speaker. She's 78 years old. Many Democrats have talked about new and younger leadership, and that is, you know, that's even among some of Nancy Pelosi's supporters. So maybe Trump is playing games with the Democrats. I suspect that's what he's doing. But one thing that can't be denied, it was a great night for women. Seems like we may have 100 female members of the House, which of course would be an all-time record. The turnout among both parties are very large. And one thing Trump said that I think I agree with, that for all the talk about a blue wave, and I'm not sure how realistic the talk of a blue wave was, the Kavanaugh hearings did change something, some kind of a dynamic, at least in the Senate races. I think it inspired and energized Republicans in these red states, in North Dakota, in Missouri, in states like that, West Virginia, where basically the treatment of Kavanaugh, the alleged mistreatment of Kavanaugh by the Democrats, did infuriate Republicans, and Trump and the GOP candidates took advantage of it.
You're listening to Ken Rudin, the political junkie, extending last night's coverage with us into today in our special extended episode of Insight. So, Ken, there were remarkable firsts in this country, and I think the number of women in politics, the number of women that were elected, is joined by the diversity of people in general who were elected to offices across the country. And you were talking through the night with Colorado Public Radio, and Colorado added part of that storyline.
That's absolutely true. Jared Polis who's a member of the Congress, a member of the House. He was elected governor, Democrat elected governor of Colorado, the first openly gay governor of any state in the country. Christy Noem, also a member of Congress from South Dakota, becomes the first female governor of South Dakota. Both Michigan and Minnesota elected Muslim American women to Congress. That's the first time that ever happened. And so, you know, there are a lot of things that, you know, a lot of surprises. Democrats won a red seat in Oklahoma. Two Republican congressmen lost in Texas. There's just been a lot of surprises. And even Mark Sanford's seat in South Carolina, he was defeated in the Republican primary by a Republican who said he wasn't pro-Trump enough. Very conservative district. A Democrat won that seat. So, you know, we're still kind of seeping, you know, going through the results and trying to, you know, understand what exactly happened. But there are some things that, you know, that we were still surprised about. And that's what makes politics such a delicious, it's not even a game, but a delicious thing to watch, is because when you think you know everything, it's clear that you don't. And many of the results that came last night were completely unexpected.
Republicans still have about 2/3 of the governor's offices across the country, but the Democrats did win governor's races from Republicans in Illinois, Kansas, Maine, Michigan, Nevada, which we haven't talked about yet, New Mexico, and Wisconsin. How about Wisconsin, Ken?
That was a big one because Scott Walker is a conservative darling. There was an attempted recall against him in 2012, funded and supported by the labor unions in Wisconsin. He beat that back. He was once upon a time, this sounds like a million years ago, he was once upon a time the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination. That's how silly calling front runners in advance is. But he was, you know, he was very well respected among conservatives. It was a very high profile defeat for him, and he lost in Wisconsin. So I think right now, I think the Republicans are now down to about 25 or 26 governors out of the 50. They still have a majority, but the Democrats certainly picked up a bunch.
Let's talk about the Nevada races, because as you and I have talked about this election overall, we both thought there would be more attention on Nevada. And the party in power has shifted there greatly, but it didn't come as much on the national stage as either you or I expected.
You know, I'm surprised. I agree with you completely. I'm surprised at that because we knew from the beginning that Dean Heller was the only Republican running for re-election in a state that was won by Hillary Clinton. So that was a risk to him to the beginning. And remember, when he started out this campaign, he was a non-Trump Republican, an anti-Trump Republican. He had questions about the tax bill and the tax cuts and things like that. He had questions about repealing the Affordable Care Act. And matter of fact, Danny Tarkanian, who was planning to run against him because there were a lot of conservatives who didn't like Heller. Heller then changed his mind, said, "I will embrace the Trump agenda." Tarkanian dropped out of that Senate race. So there were Democrats who didn't like Heller because he moved closer to Trump, and there were Republicans who didn't like Heller because he was separating himself from the president from the beginning. The combination of the two of them gave Jackie Rosen, the member of Congress from Nevada, the Democrat, an opportunity to beat him, and she did. So I'm surprised it wasn't. It was a great victory for the Democrats because in the Senate, I think she's the only Democrat who picked up a Republican seat all night long. It was mostly a Republican night for the Senate. And in the gubernatorial race as well, the name Laxalt, Adam Laxalt is the grandson of Paul Laxalt, a beloved figure in Republican politics. But Adam Laxalt, he made a lot of missteps and he said some incendiary things about women and abortion and things like that. And it was a close race, but you still have the first Democratic governor, Steve Sisolak, for the first time in, 16 years,
yeah,
something like that. And so it's now one of the few states in the country that has, I think it's the total is 14, but it's one of the few states that happened last night where the Democrats won control of not only the governorship, but both houses of the state legislature. That happened to Colorado as well and New York as well. And so that's good news for the Democrats in an election where there was not that much good news for the Democrats outside winning the House.
All right. One more point we have to cover, and that is that California's House races did not become the tipping point that we thought they would on election night. The races ended up being close, and some of the districts did move. It just didn't end up being a card in the shift of power, at least in the front of the deck, right?
Yep, I agree with you. I'm surprised at that, too. When you and I have been talking for 2 years, basically looking at all those 5, 6, 7 Republican-held seats that were won by Hillary Clinton in 2016, and we thought that if there was going to be a blue wave in the House, it was going to start or at least end in California. And right now, as we're speaking, only Dana Rohrabacher in the 48th District is trailing, and Darrell Issa's seat in the 49th also may go to the Democrats. But other seats, other Republicans like Jeff Denham, Ed Royce's seat, Mimi Walters, even Duncan Hunter in San Diego, who's under indictment, for goodness sakes, all seem to have won. The only other Republican who's in trouble is Steve Knight, I think, in the 25th District, which is just north of Los Angeles. So Steve Knight could lose, Rohrabacher could lose, and Darrell Issa's seat could go to the Democrats. But once upon a time, we thought there would be more Democratic pickups in the Golden State.
The way you're describing it, Ken, is the way that we're reporting it on our website, which we track AP results. And we're saying those results are with 100% of the precincts reporting, at least with Katie Hill over Steve Knight. And at this point with Harley Ruda over Dana Rohrabacher, too. So the Jeff Denham race as well, 100% of precincts reporting with Jeff Denham beating Josh Harder. So there's much more analysis to come. But all in all, I think as soon as we wrapped up last night, the reality was that the 2020 race seemed to have already begun, right?
Oh, there's no question about that. Already they're talking about, well, you know something? I thought that Amy Klobuchar did really well in Minnesota. Yeah, but Beto O'Rourke, even though he lost, maybe he should run for president. I mean, yeah. I think we deserve a breather. I think you and I and everybody who's inundated with politics 24/7 deserve maybe a breath or two. So maybe on, let's say Thursday, we'll pick it up again.
Okay, Ken. Thanks a lot. Rest up. I appreciate all the work you did with us through this week and all through last night. It's always great to have you as part of the team.
Thank you, Beth. I'm proud to be part of your team.
That was Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Of course, we talk every week on Capital Public Radio. Ken joins us from Washington, D.C. There's more election coverage and results at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruryak. California's Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom is now Governor-elect Newsom. Let's listen to a bit of his acceptance speech in Los Angeles last night.
There's a reason why California's dream is America's leading brand. Because California's dream has always been and always will be too big to fail and too powerful to bully. And here's the thing, the California dream, it's not binary. Every day we show how human endeavor can be both lucrative and inclusive. They aren't mutually exclusive. We don't just want success in the right hands, we want it in everybody's hands. But let's be honest, there's no doubt about this, the dream is still too distant for too many. We're a land of plenty, but we are far from perfect. Too many Californians are being priced out of housing, of health care, and higher education. Too many workers are feeling the ever-tightening squeeze of automation and wage stagnation. Too many children are growing up in poverty and starting school from behind. In many ways, in many places, we are simultaneously the richest and the poorest state. But after traveling California from region to region in a bus fueled by perpetual optimism, I'm more convinced than ever there's no problem in California that isn't somehow, somewhere being solved by a Californian.
A voice that Californians are going to become very familiar with, that is the projected governor-elect of the state, Gavin Newsom. Our Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler has been following the gubernatorial campaigns and last night was at Governor-elect Newsom's election headquarters. So let's check in with Ben. I talked with him about the direction California may go now under Gavin Newsom.
I don't think anyone's surprised that Gavin Newsom won. And by the way, at last check, as we await millions more late-arriving vote-by-mail ballots and provisional ballots and conditional voter registration, which is people registering and voting provisionally on the same day as the election, right now Newsom leads by roughly 20 points and roughly maybe 1.3 or so million votes. So that's just as large as some polls showed, larger than others, and
right.
a clear, convincing victory for Gavin Newsom and a mandate. And he will claim that mandate. He did claim that mandate last night in his victory speech.
So he talked about staying firm in California's resistance to some of the policies, almost talked about California in a way as its own country with its own mindset. And when you look at Gavin Newsom's track record, he will continue to want to blaze that trail. Talk to me, Ben, about him working with the legislature, some of the people that have been elected in the administration and lawmakers around him.
Well, one thing that is a surprise is that it looks like Democrats are going to have a two-thirds supermajority, not just in the Assembly, which was essentially a given, but also in the state Senate, which was a bit longer of a shot. And they may even have an extra vote there, and Assembly Democrats are likely to have at least two votes above a supermajority. So Democrats are truly in power in Sacramento. They certainly have been before, but with Jerry Brown doing his paddle to the left, paddle to the right thing, I think most people expect Gavin Newsom to govern more to the left of Jerry Brown. And so I think California voters have unmistakably delivered a more liberal, more progressive government to California. We'll see how that affects policies that maybe Jerry Brown or policies and budget proposals that Jerry Brown has blocked or vetoed in the past.
He's talked quite a bit about education. people around his candidacy have talked about wanting him to prioritize education, especially young early childhood education, differently than Governor Brown has done. And in looking at the state superintendent of schools race, again, how high on the priority list do you think not only will that subject be, but will it actually come to pass in terms of action?
Well, first of all, I think the state schools race is too close to call right now. It looks like Marshall Tuck is leading Tony Thurman, and Tuck is the candidate more aligned with ed reform groups and charter schools. Thurman is the candidate aligned with teachers' unions. And by the way, both are registered Democrats. Tuck is up by about 1%, and in actual votes, that looks to be maybe 75,000 or so. And again, we've got a couple million more that are going to come in. And if, as has been the case in the past, the later votes have skewed more liberal, then Thurman does have a chance of winning. Tuck was looking a lot stronger earlier in the night, and we should not assume that he is going to hold on to this seat. If he does, then that would be a bit of a difference of opinion, shall we say, on policies with him supporting some stronger education reform policies than maybe some of the Democrats in the legislature are willing to do. And that would be something very interesting to watch. But we don't know if we're going to have that.
I think what's being said is that one winner takes us in a pathway of more scrappy, fussy movement on education. The other may be a smoother path. But the bigger point is, do you think in office, Governor-elect Gavin Newsom will emphasize and change the focus, maybe the funding, some of the policies on education differently and with more priority than Governor Brown did?
Well, certainly we've heard him say that he's going to make universal preschool a priority. That's going to be pretty expensive. And we'll also see if by universal preschool he means that everyone has access to it or that it's paid, the state pays for it for everyone. Those are two different things. Similar to universal health care versus single-payer health care. Universal health care would leave, by and large, or could leave by and large, the existing system in place, but then just expand Medi-Cal and other state programs to help folks who can't afford it on their own. We also know that Newsom is committed to more money for the UC and CSU systems in higher education. We've already seen just yesterday the CSU system announced it's going to propose a budget ask to the state of nearly $500,000 new ongoing each year. They only got $100 or $200 million each year under Jerry Brown. And so I think that already is a clear sign that, people are expecting Gavin Newsom to be more willing to fund certain parts of the state budget, and that includes higher education and early education.
So a new governor, Ben, means a new first lady. And Gavin Newsom's wife, Jennifer Siebel Newsom, is prominent in her own work as a documentary film producer. She becomes a role model in a different sense now, and they have four children. So the speculation starts right away. Where might they live in Sacramento? Does the whole family move to Sacramento? What happens in terms of their personal life? Any details?
Those are good questions. I've heard various things about it, and I'm not going to speak on that until Gavin Newsom likely takes that question at whenever he meets with the press first in the days to come.
One final question about the man who ran against Gavin Newsom, John Cox. Where do you think he might go from here? Has he given any ideas about whether he entertains more of a role in public life?
He didn't say what he would do next, but John Cox has always been politically active from outside the political establishment. He has run ballot measures unsuccessfully, tried to get him on the ballot, that neighborhood legislature initiative that would have made so many more, like hundreds more, or actually I think 12,000 state lawmakers, each representing 5,000 or 10,000 Californians. So I wouldn't expect him to just, pack it in and head home, but he was embraced by the Republican establishment for this race simply because Republican Majority Leader of the House, Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield, really felt that Cox presented the best chance for leading the Republican ticket for Republican candidates to hold their House seats in California. And some of them might, some of them probably won't. It's really close results in Congress in California, and we're going to be, I think, waiting days, if not weeks, for some of these districts to sort themselves out. But Cox, I think the Republican establishment may feel he did what they wanted him to do. And I don't know if they're going to keep going back to him for more or if they're going to just shake hands and say thank you and move on.
All right, Ben, it's been a big election cycle for you. Anything else to add as we wrap up this conversation, knowing that your continuing work down there will hear in the next couple days? But any final thought on this day after the midterms?
It's going to be a new era in California. And Californians didn't just elect Gavin Newsom governor. They didn't just, in all likelihood, return Democrats to supermajority status in both chambers of the legislature. They rejected Proposition 6, which would have repealed the gas tax increase for transportation projects. And yet, they also appear to have rejected, although I think it's still too close to call, Proposition 3, the water bond. And they widely rejected Proposition 10, the measure that would have repealed the state law that limits rent control. And so there are going to be some big issues coming up next year. Housing, healthcare, not just the relatively easy to see that Democrats are likely to agree on issues like more money for higher education and early education. So those are going to be some things to watch. What kind of policies are coming out of this more liberal legislature and this more liberal governor on issues that voters chose to keep the status quo? And then just the fact that California voters did say, we want to leave the gas tax increase in place to fund these road repair projects. Democrats are going to say that's because voters see the value in these projects. Anecdotally, there is some truth to that. There is also anecdotally some truth to the fact that voters appear to have been some voters appear to have been confused by the way it appeared on the ballot,
right,
and maybe thought they were voting to repeal the gas tax when in fact they voted to leave it in place.
Yeah, when a no means a yes and a yes means a no, right?
Exactly, right. Exactly.
All right, Ben, thank you so much for your contribution in so many ways to our coverage and the vast politics that we have, especially if you go to capradio.org and the podcasts. So I know your work is continuing. We look forward to seeing you back here in Sacramento.
Thanks, Beth. Talk to you soon. And great job with you and the crew as well.
That was Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler, who was in Los Angeles. There's much more election coverage and results at capradio.org. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruriak. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. Our producers are Cody Drabble and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today, Anthony Van Hook. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.